We wish to thank General Mills Incorporated for their courtesy in relinquishing the time for their programs usually heard over some of these stations in order that we may bring you Prime Minister Chamberlain's address. Ladies and gentlemen, Germany and Czechoslovakia are still at sword's points. Germany stands pat on her ultimatum. Czechoslovakia refuses to yield. The British Parliament meets tomorrow in special session to consider the situation. But so grave does Prime Minister Chamberlain of England deem the situation today that he is not waiting for the special session of Parliament. He is speaking now, and for his speech, we take you now to London, England.
An earlier statement would not have been possible when I was flying backwards and forwards across Europe and the position was changing from hour to hour. But today, there is a lull for a brief time, and I want to say a few words to you men and women of Britain and the Empire, and perhaps to others as well. And first of all, I must say something to those who have written to my wife or myself in these last weeks to tell us of their gratitude for my efforts and to assure us of their prayers for my success. Most of these letters have come from women, mothers, or sisters of our own countrymen. But there are countless others besides, from France, from Belgium, from Italy, even from Germany. And it has been heartbreaking to read of the growing anxiety they reveal and their intense relief when they thought too soon that the danger of war was past. If I felt my responsibility heavy before, to read such letters has made it seem almost overwhelming. How horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. It seems still more impossible that a quarrel which is already settled in principle should be the subject of war. I can well understand the reasons why the Czech government have felt unable to accept the terms which have been put before them in the German memorandum. Yet I believe, after my talks with Herr Hitler, that if only time were allowed, it ought to be possible for the arrangements for transferring the territory that the Czech government has agreed to give to Germany to be settled by agreement under conditions which would ensure fair treatment for the population concerned. You know already that I have done all that one man can do to compose this quarrel. After my visits to Germany, I realized vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans, and his indignation that grievances have not been met before this. He told me privately, and last night he repeated publicly, that after this Sudeten German question is settled, that is the end of Germany's territorial claims in Europe. After my first visit to Berchtesgaden, I did get the assent of the Czech government to proposals which gave the substance of what Herr Hitler wanted. And I was taken completely by surprise when I got back to Germany and found that he insisted that the territory should be handed over to him immediately, and immediately occupied by German troops without previous arrangements for safeguarding the people within the territory who were not Germans or who did not want to join the German Reich. I must say that I find this attitude unreasonable. If it arises out of any doubts that Herr Hitler feels about the intentions of the Czech government to carry out their promises and hand over the territory, I've offered on the part of the British government to guarantee their words And I'm sure the value of our promise will not be underrated anywhere. I shall not give up the hope of a peaceful solution or abandon my efforts for peace as long as any chance for peace remains. I would not hesitate to pay even a third visit to Germany if I thought it would do any good. But at this moment, I see nothing further that I can usefully do in the way of mediation. Meanwhile, there are certain things that we can and should do at home. Volunteers are still wanted for air raid precautions, for fire brigade and police services, and for the territorial units. I know that all of you men and women alike are ready to play your part in the defense of the country, and I ask you to offer your services, if you have not already done so, to the local authorities, who will tell you if you are wanted and in what capacity. Don't be alarmed if you hear of men being called up to man anti-aircraft defenses or ships. These are only precautionary measures, such as a government must take in times like this, but they do not necessarily mean that we have determined on war or that war is imminent. However much we may sympathize with a small nation confronted by a big and powerful neighbor, we cannot, in all circumstances, undertake to involve the whole British Empire in war simply on her account. If we have to fight, it must be on larger issues than that. I am myself a man of peace to the depths of my soul. Armed conflict between nations is a nightmare to me. But if I were convinced that any nation had made up its mind to dominate the world by fear of its force, I should feel that it must be resisted. Under such a domination, life for people who believe in liberty would not be worth living. But war is a fearful thing, and we must be very clear before we embark on it that it is really the great issues that are at stake, and that the call to risk everything in their defense, when all the consequences are weighed, is irresistible. For the present, I ask you to wait as calmly as you can for the events of the next few days. As long as war has not begun, there is always hope that it may be prevented, and you know that I am going to work for peace till the last moment. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain of England speak from number 10 Downing Street in London. His address to the British Empire was brought to you over the combined networks of the National Broadcasting Company. We suggest that you stay tuned to this station for broadcasts which will keep you in close touch with the latest developments in Europe. Prime Minister Chamberlain's voice was heard in America via RCA Communications.
Ladies and gentlemen, the National Broadcasting Company, at various times throughout the morning and through the night, too, has brought you different news bulletins, keeping you posted on the situation in Europe. We understand that right now the British Parliament is in session, and for a commentary, we are taking you now to London, England.
Hello, America. Hello, America. This is London. This is a broadcast in connection with today's meeting of Parliament by Sir Frederick White and Howard Marshall. Now, first of all, I want to tell you something of how London looks on this grey autumn day of momentous decisions. I've just come up from Whitehall, the Houses of Parliament, and I was, I admit, astonished to find that there was very little crowd there. At Downing Street, there were a few people clustered. Walking up and down Whitehall and round Parliament Square was no more than a normal crowd on any particular kind of occasion. There were no mass of people, and it isn't that we don't care. That isn't why people aren't clustering round the Houses of Parliament with this so momentous debate about to begin. Of course we care, but the old slogan, I think, of carrying on is coming into operation. As I drove to Westminster past the Wellington Barracks, where the lorries were all moving about and there was great activity, and the sandbags had all just been put up over the windows, as I drove past there, I passed also the Green Park, and there I saw a boy and girl sitting on a seat, hand in hand. No crisis, it seemed, for them. Life just went on. And my stream of traffic was cluttered up with light tanks and lorries. Traffic's very congested in London now. And as we moved through Parliament Square onto the embankment, I saw there women auxiliaries, and there were a couple of Chelsea pensioners in their red coats leaning over as near as they could be to the Houses of Parliament. Old fighting men drawn back by this threat of war, and a pavement artist among the scuttering plane leaves, standing there working away unnoticed, and then suddenly a glimpse of tin hats just over the grey parapet of the embankment. Soldiers working on the fire floats down below there, and further in the air, a strange sight to see in a city street, an anti-aircraft gun already pointing skywards, and alongside it the ammunition dump covered with tarpaulin, and scrawled on it in white chalk, "No smoking," with a youngster standing in front of it, a youngster in khaki with his rifle, looking almost bewildered at being pitchforked into this, and all around him the business crowd of clerks and businessmen standing and looking. Well, the signs, as you see, are spasmodic rather than general. We see this outcrop of the possibility of war in these tanks and lorries, in the anti-aircraft guns, and In Hyde Park and our other green spaces where we find people digging trenches. But on the whole, the feeling all round is undoubtedly that while here we are preparing for the worst, at least we're still hoping for the best. And that's rather how it is. And members of Parliament this morning at dawn began taking their plans for this historic debate. And now I'm going to ask Sir Frederick White, who was himself a member of Parliament for 10 years, to tell you exactly what's going on in Parliament at this moment.
The House of Commons is on a day of crisis. It's 2:45 p.m. First, the Speaker's procession, headed by the mace-bearer, followed by the sergeant-at-arms, the Speaker's chaplain, and the Speaker himself in his wig and heavy gold robe. The House rises to its feet. The chaplain intones the prayer that wisdom may attend the deliberations of His Majesty's servants, and that the grace of God may sustain the King. Usually, of course, this is rather a perfunctory performance of an ordinary ceremonial duty. But today, it is instinct and informed with, what shall I call it, dramatic solemnity. It's happened before in our time, this significant emphasis on an otherwise commonplace religious ceremony. And my mind goes back to 1914, when Sir Edward Grey told the House at 3 o'clock on August the 4th that the die was cast. And the House meets today with a tragic sense that history is about to repeat itself. And your minds will perhaps go back to a more recent date, when in the same surroundings, something of the same atmosphere of tense expectation, Stanley Baldwin, then Prime Minister, walked slowly up the floor of the House to announce the abdication of King Edward VIII. This afternoon, the House of Commons met in a mood even more tense, hoping against hope, yet filled with that sense of ominous anticipation with which men await the breaking of the storm from a threatening sky. Well, just look for a moment at this historic House of Commons. Some of you know it, of course. This unique legislative chamber, unique, I mean, in shape, for it's not in a semicircle, as, for instance, the Senate or the Chamber of Deputies is, but a long rectangular hall with tiers of seats ranged in parallel rows opposite one another, filled to the brim with expectant members of Parliament. We've seen them come in, these members, Conservative, Liberal, and Labour, divided from one another by the ordinary party divisions, but united today by the sense that England is one in the face of danger. They are grave and solemn rather than excited. There's an air of tension about the House. And there in comes Mr. Lloyd George, short, stocky, walking to his seat with the jaunty air of a youngster, in spite of the shaggy white head that reminds us all that he has sat here in this House for nearly 50 years. Hard on his heels comes Winston Churchill, with a sort of air of historic tragedy about him. He goes to his seat below the gangway on the government side with a grim, square jaw which seems to bid defiance to all comers. And no sooner has the House taken note of him than there appears another figure, slim, debonair, yet seeming to combine the high seriousness of state affairs with the pleasant, smiling appeal of youth. Anthony Eden. And when they have all taken their seats, the sergeant-at-arms makes a signal to the chief attendant, who strides to the door and announces the orders of the day, which means that business has begun. But while this time-honored ceremony was proceeding, this ceremony which heralds the opening of the daily session of the House of Commons, the Prime Minister slips in almost unnoticed and takes his place on the front bench. But of course not really unnoticed, for his appearance is the immediate signal for that long, slow crescendo of cheers, that chorus of hear, 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 which some of you who've attended the House will remember, with which the House always greets a national leader in moments of high decision. And so the scene is set. The silence that follows
an actual announcement that business is about to begin. That follows the swelling chorus of cheers that greeted the Prime Minister is almost unbearable. The Speaker rises from his chair and calls upon the Prime Minister by his time-honored title as First Lord of the Treasury. Mr. Chamberlain rises to his feet. He is an older man than he was when he flew to Bavaria 2 weeks ago, but also in the eyes of all men, he is a greater man. Just stop a minute to size him up. When he succeeded Stanley Baldwin as Prime Minister, he was little known even to his own people. But today it's true to say that in his mind, in his attitude, in his character, he seems to us to be the incarnation of the peculiar, perhaps insular qualities of his people, and also of their invincible strength. He has been unknown because he has never dramatized himself for the public. He has never exploited the arts of popular advertisement, which film stars and dictators find so necessary to their public appeal. And the result is that even his facial features have only recently become known to the general public. No, Neville Chamberlain has left his work to speak for itself. But today, he is describing to the House of Commons how he discharged the greatest task that he ever undertook in his life. A greater task, perhaps, than any Prime Minister has ever undertaken before. He begins in quiet,
low tones.
If you were in the House today, you would see members of Parliament leaning forward with a sort of strained attention, as if they were afraid to miss a single word of what he says. And in a moment or two, we shall be able to give you exactly his words.
He must, I suppose, just now be starting to speak.
Yes, there will be a little delay before we get the actual words, because there always must be a lag between the time the opening words of a speech are delivered and the time that they can come over the tape to us at the microphone. But you see the scene. You've got it before you. And here is the first part of the message.
The message tells of the state of the House and how crowded it was after the prayers had been taken and the chaplain backed out. All the seats were already filled. Members were crowding the gallery.
Well, Mr. Chamberlain actually entered the House at 2:40. That process of prayers and the general assembling of the House takes always a few minutes.
In the meanwhile, everybody's standing by, and it's rather awe-inspiring to think at this moment how many people the world over, how many millions of people are awaiting this speech in the House of Commons, this speech upon which so many tremendous decisions, so many tremendous possibilities rest and hang.
And if you had been mixing with the members in the lobby this afternoon before the House actually met, you would have heard, of course, comment on all sorts of things, but friendly and interested comment on the remarkable intervention of the President, of President Roosevelt, in our European crisis. He made a great effort to keep the door open.
And I have here another message. Messages are being handed in to us which come straight from the House of Commons. A message describing how members stood up in their places, waving their order papers over their heads and cheering Mr. Chamberlain as he entered the House. And then came the first business of the day, which was a question with regard to war risks, addressed to the Prime Minister, who didn't answer it. It was answered by Sir John Simon.
Of course, the ordinary proceedings of the House have been put on one side. Those of you who've attended debates in the House will remember that usually, after prayers, When the speaker has taken the chair, the first 40 minutes or so are occupied by questions asked of ministers on all conceivable subjects of public administration. The arrangement today has been that these are postponed to a more appropriate moment in order that the entire afternoon may be devoted to the one thing that is in all men's minds, namely the Prime Minister's account of the discharge of the great duty which he undertook when he flew to Bashta's Garden a fortnight ago.
I take it, then, that there won't be other questions after this war risk question.
I think
has already been...
No, I think that probably was allowed as an urgent question because it was desirable that the public should know what the government policy in that particular matter would be. My understanding was that ordinary questions had been postponed in order to leave room, as I say, for the only business that is in everybody's mind.
Yes, well, naturally, there are matters of public policy and interest which must be cleared up.
Yes, things that are desirable. It's desirable that the public should know at once what government action is to be taken.
Yes.
And I should think we shall probably hear further announcements about the fleet movements that were announced by the Secretary of the Admiralty last night, and such other things as the government feels that the public ought to be acquainted with at once.
It would have been extremely interesting to have been in the lobbies just before to hear what the general run of comment was.
Yes.
And here is news of another question asked by Mr. Attlee about the business of the House, to which Mr. Chamberlain himself replied and said that the House would meet tomorrow to continue this debate on the international situation. He said that, of course, he couldn't give further information at present with regard to business, but that he'd keep the House informed from day to day. And when this question had been answered, Captain Margeson immediately marked adjournment of the House in order to give the Prime Minister an opportunity of making his statement on international affairs, so that we may expect at any moment now the beginning of Mr. Chamberlain's speech.
Yes. Of course, by the way, moving the adjournment of the House doesn't mean that the House is going to adjourn. That's only the parliamentary way of getting normal business out of the way in order to proceed to this abnormal business.
Yes, and he rose, I now see, at 2:55 p.m. precisely to begin his statement. And he started by saying, "Today we are faced with a situation which has no parallel since 1914. And that is just what Sir Frederick White has been saying, that it puts us all in mind of the feelings which were uppermost at that very tense time."
It does indeed. And of course, the public just still, as Mr. Marshall was telling you, that it is a quiet public today. They are prepared for anything. And yet somehow they can't quite bring themselves to believe that the foundations of the world are going to break up once more for the second time in 20 years.
No, I think it's the strongest thing one notices today, this feeling among people that the miracle must happen, that really all common sense and logic are on the side of the miracle happening, even at the 11th hour.
Yes, hoping against hope, but at the same time preparing.
Preparing and the intensity of the preparations which are going on are equally startling and very welcome indeed. You find it on every side, the amazing energy which is being displayed. Don't you agree?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, of course, people can't make up their minds whether their duty is to plunge immediately into some form of national service or to stick to their own jobs. They're pulled in two ways at once.
Well, it is a nice complex situation, isn't it?
It is.
After all, this carrying on has got to be remembered, and there is the temptation, isn't there, to put everything aside and rush to do something else.
But I think one thing certain is that where at the outbreak of the Great War, it was go as you please, and you entered the Army or the Navy or the Air Force or any unit that you preferred. Today, the personal choice of the individual will be put on one side, and they will be taken charge by the government from the outside in a form of legal national service.
Yes, I think that's very probable. And I now have another notice, but this one doesn't refer to Mr. Chamberlain's speech. And it just says how full the house was again, and that the Lord's Gallery was quickly filled, and among the first to enter the Lord's Gallery were Earl Baldwin and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Nearly all the members of the cabinet were present.
The Prime Minister went on. I cannot help reflecting that if Article 19 of the Covenant, that's the Covenant of the League, providing for the revision of treaties by agreement, had been put into operation as was contemplated, instead of allowing passion to become so exasperated that revision by agreement became impossible, we might have avoided the crisis. That's so far all we have of the beginning of the Prime Minister's speech.
I see a notice coming in at this moment, which says, Mr. Chamberlain went on, in July the government was faced with a position that a deadlock had been reached between Czechs and Sudetans, and fears were entertained that Germany might speedily intervene if it were not settled. Mr. Chamberlain, you'll realize, is going back over the history of the crisis, how it arose. He wishes to make it perfectly clear the position this country has taken up throughout. Once more is a little message coming in. The government, said Mr. Chamberlain, had three alternatives. One, it could have threatened Germany with war if she attacked the Czechs. Two, England could have stood aside. Three, the government could have attempted mediation. Though we know, of course, which policy the government did adopt.
And yet, for anyone who could read between the lines, Prime Minister's speech on March the 24th and Sir John Simon's repetition of the government attitude in his speech in Lanark in Scotland in August. I say for anybody who could read between the lines, it was quite clear that the government was well aware that the alternative of facing a situation which would require the use of force by Great Britain was present. And I think that the Prime Minister has always assumed that everybody knew that and that he didn't want to do anything to prejudice the situation and therefore chose the method of conciliation.
And he went on in his speech, this country had no treaty obligations with the Czechs. It did not readily resort to war, and the people might not have followed the government if they had tried to lead the country into war to prevent a minority from obtaining autonomy. And that, of course, was a very strong feeling in people's minds, wasn't it, in the early stages?
Certainly.
And it's amazing how feeling has hardened in the country, isn't it?
Yes, feeling in the country seems to me to have gone through several very interesting phases. First, a complete unity of support for Mr. Chamberlain on his first flight to Berchtesgaden. Then, following his quick return from Berchtesgaden, a division of opinion based upon an uncertainty as to what had happened in Berchtesgaden. A tendency on the part of some to criticize the Prime Minister for something they supposed him to have done. But now all those divisions, in the course of the last 3 or 4 days, have disappeared altogether.
The second course, the Prime Minister went on, the second course was also repugnant. However remote the Czech territory, a spark arising there might give rise to a general conflagration. Therefore, he said, the government felt it their duty to try to help the parties to come to a settlement, and they addressed themselves to mediation. And that, of course, was the origin of Lord Runciman's mission to Czechoslovakia.
Now, let's just repeat exactly what Mr. Chamberlain said regarding the three courses. Marshal, what were his exact words? Because I've no doubt that he'll refer to it again
just look quick.
The point just put by Mr. Chamberlain was the government felt it to be their duty to try to help the parties to come to a settlement, and they addressed themselves to mediation, as you know.
The government, those three alternatives you were talking about, Sir Frederick, were one, the government could have threatened Germany with war if she attacked the Czechs. Two, England could have stood aside. Three, England could have attempted mediation. Mm. The moment we have no more information coming through, but our messengers are running to and from the tape machines, bringing them into us as they come. And it's a queer feeling, sitting here waiting for the Prime Minister's words to come over that tape machine and following the course of his speech in this odd manner.
We're talking to you from a studio in Broadcasting House. That's to say, the home of the British Broadcasting Corporation. And we're just as anxious as you are to get the next passage in the speech.
Very anxious indeed.
We can't overcome physical obstacles, and we and you have got to possess our souls in patience while the process of transmission goes on.
Quite probably it will detect a kind of certain anxiety in our voices and demeanor as we sit in front of the microphone here, waiting to give you the news.
Knowing quite well that you don't want to listen to us, but to Mr. Chamberlain's words.
And being in the position of finding it quite impossible, obviously, to make comment on this speech as it comes over so slowly and in such brief morsels.
Yes, our comment would be painting the lily.
Well, indeed. But I do find among people in general an extraordinary feeling of quiet confidence, don't you?
Oh, yes.
People over here are naturally desperately anxious, worried about their own family affairs and so on and so forth. But underlying it all is that note of a calm and confidence.
And, of course, there's this great difference between the present situation and 1914... that in 1914, it was a completely unknown future that we were facing. The generation that had grown up before the war had no conception whatever of what war was. The world since then has known it, and we know more what we are facing. And so there's an element of decision and certainty.
Yeah, we have a rather longer portion of the minister's speech. And this is apparently where he began. This is an earlier portion. Shortly before the House adjourned, at any rate, he said, speaking on a formal motion for the adjournment, "At the end of July, I remember that some questions were addressed to me as to the possibility of summoning the House before the time arranged and during the recess in certain eventualities." The Prime Minister then spoke, as you have heard already, and went on by referring to the services of Lord Runciman. Lord Runciman, he said, did not succeed through no fault of his, and we, and indeed all Europe, must ever be grateful to him and to his task for the very long and exhausting efforts on behalf of peace, in the course of which he gained the esteem and the confidence of both sides. Mr. Chamberlain went on to trace the course of the negotiations and said that by the middle of August, it had become clear to Lord Runciman that the gap between the proposals of the two parties was too wide to permit of the negotiations between the parties on their basis at that time.
And Mr. Chamberlain then went on to say, Lord Runciman was largely instrumental in inducing Dr. Benesch to put forward new proposals, which appeared to have been regarded by the Sudeten leaders as a suitable basis for the continuance of the negotiations. That presumably refers to what people called Benesch's fourth plan.
Yes.
Which certainly looked, from the outside at all events, to be as far as the Czech government could possibly go.
Yes.
And yet, of course, as we know, eventually they were persuaded to go further.
Very much further.
In order to stave off war in Europe.
The admission of Lord Grunsmond must have been an extraordinarily exacting and difficult one, wasn't it, in the circumstances?
Extremely. That must have added years to his life.
Must indeed. Here we come. There's another little bit. And Lord, Mr. Chamberlain went on, talking about Lord Runciman's mission. Prospects of negotiations being carried to a successful conclusion were handicapped by a recurrence of incidents. Herr Henlein, he said, took to Berchtesgaden on September the 2nd a message from Lord Runciman expressing the hope that Herr Hitler would continue to give his support to the negotiations which were proceeding.
And we in this country took the dispatch of Lord Runciman at the earliest stage in this trouble as the obvious pledge given by the British government of their interest in the particular problem, though they had no treaty obligation to it, and the determination on the part of the government to leave nothing undone as far as they could do it to help the Germans and the Czechs, Sudeten Germans, I mean, and the Czechs, to solve a problem which was becoming unmanageable.
Right. Yes, it was a pledge to a vital interest we had in the thing, which apparently Herr Hitler, in his speech, neglected. The pledge we had of guaranteeing the fulfillment of the conditions.
Yeah. Prime Minister went on. During August, Lord Runciman's efforts in bringing Czechs and Sudeten Germans together met with considerable success. Meanwhile, however, developments in Germany itself had caused anxiety to the government. On July the 28th, Lord Halifax, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax wrote a personal letter to Herr von Ribbentrop, no doubt believing that Herr von Ribbentrop was the best channel through which to reach the Führer himself.
And that, of course, has been the extraordinary thing about these negotiations, the breaking down of diplomatic channels in every conceivable way, the effort to make it a personal approach direct. The effort so far seems to have failed.
Yes. Well, that's all the news so far, but there'll be another passage coming along
just
almost at once.
This moment coming in. Probably hear the door open as the messenger rushes in with it. And then Mr. Chamberlain went on. In this, Lord Halifax, that's his letter to Herr Ribbentrop, in this, Lord Halifax expressed regret at the statement of the British ambassador in Berlin that the Germans reserved their attitude towards Lord Runciman's mission and regarded it as a matter of purely British concern. Lord Halifax expressed the hope that the Germans would collaborate in obtaining a peaceful solution.
And remember, the date of that letter was July the 28th.
Long ago is that?
2 months ago today. By the way, it's an interesting fact that today is the day the Czechs celebrate the assassination of the most famous of all the kings of Bohemia, whom you know very well in America, and so do we here, namely good King Wenceslas.
We sing about him at a far happier time of
the
year.
Yeah, we do indeed. He was assassinated on the 28th of September, 929, over 1,000 years ago.
He was king of the old kingdom of Bohemia.
Old kingdom of Bohemia, at a time when Bohemia was one of the great powers in Central Europe. Incidentally, of course, that shows what a long history the Czechs had behind them.
And that is a thing which has been very much overlooked, hasn't it? They're regarded as a newly founded state.
They're regarded as upstarts, whereas they were anything but that.
Well, here's more of Mr. Chamberlain's speech. He went on, early in August, the British government began to receive reports of military preparations in Germany on an extensive scale. Among other things, these included the conscription of labor for the fortifications of Germany's western frontier. The measures involved a widespread dislocation of civilian life and could not fail to be regarded as equivalent to a partial mobilization.
As early as that?
That's in August. Early in August. And somehow or other, time seems to have been telescoped of late. It's very difficult to realize that these things happened so long ago, isn't it, actually? And that's a thing we over here are feeling a great deal. The last few days seem to have gone without time, without date, without anything at all. They've all been merged into a speculation and even rumor, queer things, that rumors that have been going around. But I haven't noticed the crop of rumors that one would expect at this time.
No.
That's another.
Yes, there's much less of that, of those artificial aids to excitement that usually circulate at times like these.
Yes, you usually get one after another, don't you? But people seem to be keeping much quiet. Of course, as you were saying, we have had this time a time for collecting ourselves and preparing. Now, 1914 leapt upon the general public, didn't it, so suddenly?
Oh, completely. Before, took them completely by surprise.
Whereas we've been gradually led up to this, we've been thinking about it. We've made so many of our preparations. And actually, now in London, we individuals are very perplexed to know quite what to do. Families with children, they are already, as a measure of common sense, not of panic, beginning to evacuate their children.
Here's the next passage. These military preparations, the Prime Minister went on, suggested that the German government was determined to solve the Sudeten question by force. The British ambassador in Berlin was then instructed to point out that these abnormal measures could not fail to be interpreted as a threatening gesture to Czechoslovakia and might increase the tension. The ambassador was also instructed to point out that these preparations might compel the Czechs to take counter-precautions. That's so far all we have. And it's a very material point.
It is, indeed.
Once you get into what they call the military timetable, the thing goes on inexorably. You're all on the slippery slope and can't stop.
The machine has started. But that warning was delivered. When was that? In early
in
August?
Plenty of time. The warning was delivered in August, you see.
In August.
Lord Halifax's letter is dated July the 28th. The Prime Minister doesn't specify a date in August when this information about German preparations came to him, but he says it was in August. Let's see. Getting on to 2 months ago now.
Yes. And ever since then, it's just been cumulative. But as I was saying, it is difficult indeed from the personal point of view to know quite what to do about things of that sort. You were saying whether to go on or as usual or not. I personally am taking the precaution of getting my children out of London, but that, as I say, I feel is just sense and common sense. Well, now, here's a small addition to the Prime Minister's speech. It was added, he said, that such developments would be almost certain to destroy the chances of Lord Runciman's success, the developments, that's to say, of the partial mobilization of the German troops, and might endanger the peace of every one of the great powers of Europe. It was added that they might also destroy the prospect of a resumption of Anglo-German negotiations. So that the speaking then was pretty plain, even at that stage, wasn't it?
That was about as clear a warning as could be given without being too explicit.
Yes.
Not only of the interest that the British government was taking in the situation, but of the fact that we might be more deeply involved. That we might be compelled to take action.
And on this point of being explicit, there have been criticisms that we haven't been explicit enough. But it's always been the Chamberlain's aim to avoid anything which might cause irritation or place anybody in a difficulty from which they couldn't retreat or a position from which they couldn't retreat, if need be.
And that reminds me of a point that I was asked by your well-known commentator, Hans von Kaltenborn, the other night, when I was doing a talk with the microphone here about the situation. He asked me, remember, what the British attitude was to the rather extraordinary fact that the greater part of the news published in British newspapers, transmitted from our wireless stations, was news coming from foreign sources, and that the actual news supplied from British official sources was very small indeed. I think that perhaps was part of the necessary price we had to pay for the government's determination to say and do nothing that would make the situation more difficult.
Just one short addition here. That in reply to this British protest, Herr von Ribbentrop expressed the opinion that British efforts in Prague had only served to increase Czech intransigence.
He said that already, that
is fair. He said that, apparently in August.
That was the German official reaction to Runciman's mission.
Yes. It looks as if things have taken shape in Germany a long time ago, doesn't it? It would appear so, at any rate.
It looks as if this cloud was already a good deal darker in August than any of us believed.
When we were all away, or a great many of us away on holiday.
Well, thank goodness we did get to holiday anyway.
Well, we got there. That's something. But that point of yours that you were making about news is a very important one, isn't it?
Very. We had to make up our minds very largely on interpretations of the situation that came from German official sources, from German newspapers, from what might be called leakage of news in other European centers, while our own government preserved an almost complete silence and allowed its actually known acts to speak for themselves.
Yes. A difficult attitude to maintain, but a very important one. In fact, all along, Mr. Chamberlain's position has been incredibly difficult, hasn't it? This fact of having to preserve, from a policy point of view, having to preserve silence, as he did. In spite, as you said, of the criticism which was leveled at him by people who actually weren't able to show themselves of the facts on which they based it. Mm.
There was a good deal of natural feeling about it. But I imagine that the Prime Minister and the government felt that they could rely on the support of public opinion. After all, democracy works that way. You elect your leaders and you place the responsibility on them. And one of the things you do in electing them and putting them in that place is deliberately to give them the choice of when and how they will explain their own acts.
Yes. But here's another piece of Mr. Chamberlain's speech. Mr. Chamberlain spoke of the recall to London of Sir Neville Henderson for a consultation. That's the British ambassador in Berlin. And said that on his return to Berlin on August the 31st, he made a strong personal warning to the State Secretary of the Wilhelmstrasse regarding the probable attitude of the British government in the event of German aggression in Czechoslovakia, particularly if France were compelled to intervene. On September the 1st, he repeated in a personal and most urgent message to Herr von Ribbentrop the warning already given to the State Secretary. The British government desired to impress the situation upon the German government without risking further aggravation by formal representations which might be interpreted by the German government as a public rebuff.
Now, let's see. Well, how does the timetable go? Halifax wrote his letter on July the 28th. News comes to the ears of the British government of military preparations in Germany sometime in August, and this warning is when...
In August the 31st, the first warning went to the State Secretary of the Wilhelmstrasse through Sir Neville Henderson, and after that, on September the 1st, Mr. Chamberlain repeated this warning in a personal, most urgent message to Herr von Ribbentrop. That was on September the 1st already, that they had made this point very strongly. Practically a month ago.
Oh, does Chamberlain say that he himself...
Well, wait a minute, it's a little difficult to...
That he, I think, refers to the British ambassador in Berlin.
He repeated in a personal, and most, the word personal, which looks as if it must have been Chamberlain. So that any charges that we haven't made our position tolerably clear in the early stages seem to fall down, don't they?
And therefore, a great part of the criticism leveled at Mr. Chamberlain by, especially by his normal political opponents, falls to the ground because their charge rested on the fact that he hadn't made it.
Entirely, yes.
Mr. Chamberlain then spoke of the recall to London of Sir Neville Henderson, British ambassador in Berlin, for a consultation.
And said that on his return to Berlin on August the 31st, he made a strong personal warning to the Secretary of State of the Wilhelmstrasse regarding the probable attitude of the British government in the event of German aggression in Czechoslovakia, particularly if France were compelled to intervene. Yes, you see, that's a repetition.
I think it's an important repetition anyway, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That point should be driven home.
The Prime Minister then went on. The British government had to bear in mind the approach of the Nazi Party Congress at Nuremberg. And accordingly, Dr. Benesch was approached. And it was emphasized to him that it was in the interests of Czechoslovakia to offer immediately those Czech concessions without which the Sudeten question could not be settled. It's extraordinary how this story begins to unroll, and all the bits that were dark and unknown to us before
begin to fit into place
and make a coherent, and I should think from the point of view of all except German opinion, a convincing whole.
A convincing whole and a logical whole has been policy has been maintained, as far as one can see so far, consistently throughout, from the first intimations of crisis arising, and has been put with more and more force. And I await with very great interest Mr. Chamberlain's account of his conversations at Berchtesgaden and Gottesberg.
Yes, indeed.
Now, we're approaching that now. That must be coming quite soon, I take it. We're into September now.
Yes, Mr. Chamberlain, as you said,
the National Broadcasting Company is bringing you a commentary on the speech of Prime Minister Chamberlain to the British Parliament, which is now in session.
The Czech government should go forthwith, unreservedly, to the limit of concessions. Dr. Benesch responded to these representations by putting forward proposals afterwards known as the Fourth Plan. Autonomy within the Czech state seemed not impossible when the Czech government published this Fourth Plan. Unfortunately, said Mr. Chamberlain, incidents occurred, and though it appeared that these had been much exaggerated, the Sudeten leaders determined not to resume negotiations until they had been liquidated. Well, that's all for the moment. But there was that feeling that the Czech government should go unreservedly to the limit of concessions. Every effort was being made there to see that no cause for bitterness arose. And then it comes, of course, after this, the Nuremberg conference itself, doesn't it, for which we awaited with such tremendous interest, and we wished to know exactly what line Herr Hitler was going to take, because that was his first statement as Führer of the German attitude to the situation. And we waited that Tuesday evening speech. I remember racing across the country in the south of England in order to get to a wireless set, not being able to get to one, but stopping a passing car in Ashdown Forest, which had a wireless set, and trying to get the speech or the resume of it in the black darkness there and the wind of a wild night, feeling that this was something momentous. And then, in fact, feeling that it was the flash in the pan. But the Prime Minister went on, the Czechs took immediate steps to liquidate the situation. But further incidents occurred, and negotiations could not be resumed before Hitler made his speech, winding up the Nuremberg conference. Before that speech, His Majesty's government had made further efforts to exercise a restraining influence on Germany. The French government had been insistent that nothing should be left undone to make the attitude of the British government known to the Chancellor himself. At Nuremberg, Sir Neville Henderson spoke to various leading Germans, bringing their attention to the Prime Minister's speech of March the 24th and Sir John Simon's on August the 27th, of which you reminded us just now, Sir Freddie. That's all we have at the moment.
It
was anticipated this morning that the Prime Minister's speech would take something well over an hour. It looks like being at least that. The British ambassador after Nuremberg reported that as the result of his representations, there could be no doubt that the German government were aware of the British attitude.
Yes, of course, that was a crucial point. We always felt that the British attitude might not penetrate to the Führer, didn't we? It was a feeling we had in the earliest phases, at any rate.
But we also felt, I think, that the Prime Minister wouldn't have gone out of his way to send Neville Henderson to Nuremberg unless he had something perfectly explicit to say to the Führer.
Yeah. Here are two more. Then he went on September the 9th, the British cabinet met and decided as a precaution to commission mine layers in minesweepers. On September the 9th, that was. On September the 11th, the Prime Minister said he had himself published a statement stressing the close ties between England and France and the probability of this country going to French assistance in certain eventualities. Well, that comes as a surprise that on September the 9th we were already commissioning minesweepers and mine layers. At least it does to me. Although, obviously, precautions must have been taken even then. And now we notice the French side of it is coming in much more into this speech, isn't it?
Yes, it's bound to come in more and more, because as the crisis developed, the communication between Paris and London was practically uninterrupted day and night.
Yes. Although it has been very close indeed with this in view for the whole crisis, hasn't it, really, since the only possible heirs. As you were saying, we anticipated at first, before this speech started, that it would take approximately 45 minutes. But by the way it's going, it will be considerably longer. Well, while we're waiting, we have here flashes of news from your country. The United States Naval Authorities, we're told, have ordered three more cruisers to proceed from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And it's learned that the Savannah and the Sumners are en route to England, and their exact destination not being announced.
The problem of the departing American visitor is not nearly so acute now as it was in August 1914, because so many of the travelers and holidaymakers from your country have already gone home again. And the problem of housing them and looking after them isn't anything like so difficult as it was 20 years ago. But there are still enough about for us, for instance, in places like... of course, naturally, in the American embassy, but in places like the English-speaking Union, to be aware of the difficulties and anxieties of your fellow countrymen and fellow countrywomen who are over here.
Now, the Prime Minister went on September the 12th, Hitler laid stress on the military precautions taken in the West and said the world could no longer tolerate the oppression of the Sudeten Germans. For the first time, Hitler promised in this speech the support of the Reich to the Sudetens if they could not obtain satisfaction for themselves. And for the first time, he raised the issue of self-determination. But, added Mr. Chamberlain, he did not close the door to negotiations nor demand a plebiscite.
Yes, people who have been following the situation closely interpreted the Nuremberg speech as the signal to the Sudeten Germans inside Czechoslovakia to accelerate their preparations and to force the issue more and more with the Czech government. That was the interpretation given on the spot of the meaning. The speech really was the hoisting of a signal to the Sudetens. Now go ahead and do your worst.
Yes.
Well, that was interpretation or not, I don't know, but it has been borne out by events.
Very much so. Mm. No getting away from that. Now, I suppose
Americans in this country and in Paris also are worrying about getting away. Although I was talking to someone who'd just come out from Paris this morning, and they say it's quite extraordinary, the calm in Paris and the excellent way all mm-hmm. kinds of arrangements are being made of mm-hmm. that kind.
Mr. Chamberlain then said that on the 14th of September, that's exactly a fortnight ago, Herr von Rhein issued a proclamation stating that the Carlsbad points, you remember the 8 Carlsbad points, that the Carlsbad points were no longer enough, and that the situation called for self-determination. Herr Henlein stayed in Germany, where it was understood he had since occupied himself with a Sudeten legionary organization reported to number 40,000 men. In these circumstances, continued the Prime Minister, in these circumstances, Lord Rossimann felt that no useful purpose could be served by publishing a plan of his own. And so far, that's all we've got.
Well, that sounds
like there's been a good deal of speculation in this country as to whether Lord Rossimann had written a report which he had transmitted to the British government, or whether he conceived it to be his duty merely to give such advice as he could to the government in Prague and to act as mediator over there. I should suppose that when the time comes, as it may come very soon, that Lord Runciman's report, or at least the substance of it, will form part of the Blue Book of British documents, which must eventually be published, giving the story of the crisis.
Yes. Oh, that'll be an integral part of it, won't it?
Surely, I should think so. Unless the government feel that they merely supplied Lord Runciman as a mediator and that their responsibility ended for the moment with his dispatch to Prague, that the responsibility then rested on him to do what he could between Dr. Benesch and Henlein.
Yes. Then, went on Mr. Chamberlain, on September the 14th, a highly critical situation had developed, in which there was an immediate danger of German troops concentrated on the frontier entering Czechoslovakia. In those circumstances, said Mr. Chamberlain, I decided that the time had come to put into operation a plan which I had had in my mind for a considerable period of the last resort. Well, that brings us, of course, to Berchtesgaden, doesn't it? Very dramatic fight. I always remember the feeling of intense relief we felt, possibly prematurely, but at any rate we felt when it was announced suddenly that this was to take place. That was an extraordinary evening there. And the feeling that here was something being done which was away from all the slow and rather cumbrous methods of negotiation which had taken part in the past.
And so unlike the character of the Prime Minister, at least as far as the public knew it.
Yes, this decisive and
something
personal.
Something much more dramatic.
Yes.
Than you'd have expected, man.
Well, again, I was down in the country at that time, and you have an odd feeling, you know, in the country at these times, you're cut off from things you don't really know. You're not really in touch. They're all very apprehensive, and the extraordinary feeling of eased tension which came over the house party where I was staying, and that news came over the wireless. Suddenly, a bolt out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt, well, at least something is being tried at any rate. Because that was a time, as that last part of Mr. Chamberlain's speech said, when everyone was extremely apprehensive when the German troops were on the Czech border, wasn't it, at the moment of
great tension. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the speech, of course, now corroborates the common belief, especially in what are called well-informed quarters, that what had brought Mr. Chamberlain to an apparently sudden decision was the news that the kind of military preparations that they'd been aware of for over 4 or 5 weeks past had reached a crucial point.
Yes.
And that Germany might act at any given moment.
Yes. Well, here's another bit of the speech coming.
Prime Minister went on, one of the principal difficulties in dealing with a totalitarian government is the lack of any means of establishing contact with the personalities in whose hands lie the final decision. So, I resolved to go to Germany myself to interview Herr Hitler and find out in personal conversation whether there was yet any hope of saving peace. That sentence in the Prime Minister's speech was greeted with loud and resounding cheers from the entire House.
As well it might be, I think.
Oh, indeed.
through the day.
Up till then, according to the record before us, the house must have listened in almost complete silence.
Yes.
That silence of tense interest to the Prime Minister. And then it let itself go in a cheer of relief.
Yes. And then, Mr. Chamberlain went on, I knew very well in taking such a course, I was laying myself open to criticism on the ground that I was detracting from the dignity of British Prime Ministers. Cries then from the members of no, no. And he went on to disappointment and to perhaps even resentment if I failed to bring back a satisfactory agreement. And, of course, it's very true that he did lay himself open to all those charges, and some of those charges were, on insufficient evidence, in due course made.
Okay.
But those things we can now discount. The feeling has come round entirely to the... We're waiting now for the facts. And, as you said before, the facts do seem to be fitting so logically into the picture, don't they?
They do.
And what's more, another odd thing, the things which we divine, or the public divine, from the papers, the general feeling has been fairly accurate right the way through,
hasn't it? Fairly accurate, yes.
Although it's been based on largely on speculation, but somehow the true state of affairs in this country, at any rate, seems to have percolated.
Indeed, yes. The Prime Minister continued, I felt that in such a crisis, where the issues at stake were so vital to so many millions of human beings, considerations of that kind could not be allowed to weigh.
But the Prime Minister is essentially a man, a quiet man, a retiring man, a man who dislikes spectacular, dramatic displays of any kind.
Mm.
I always feel he'd far rather be away somewhere fishing than if a strong sense of duty didn't embroil him in these affairs.
Mm.
But he's that type of man altogether, isn't he?
I remember long ago, my friends in Birmingham used to say, when people had been talking about his father, Joseph Chamberlain, or about Austen, they say, oh, you wait till Neville gets into public life, and then you'll see a real man. Well, it's a curious comment on Chamberlain's career that he didn't enter the House of Commons at all as a member till after I had left it. He's an entirely post-war product in national politics.
But that's a remarkable thing, isn't it? He seems grafted under the stock of politics, isn't he, somehow? Now, then Mr. Chamberlain went on to describe his first visit to Herr Hitler at Berchtesgaden. He was, he confessed, astonished at the warmth of the approval with which his adventure was everywhere approved. The relief which...
The National Broadcasting Company has brought you a discussion and a commentary on the speech of Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, this broadcast coming to you direct from London, England. And now, for a further commentary, we bring you Stanley High, commentator and journalist.
I've been listening to this broadcast here in the studios of the National Broadcasting Company and making notes as I've been listening to Mr. Chamberlain's speech brought in London. Some way in getting the background of this British picture this morning, I've had the feeling... From the descriptions of the street scenes in London and from the calm and the lack of frenzy in all those who've spoken, I've had the feeling that the British people wishes that Great Britain were located somewhere else than so close to Europe. That by and large, the average English citizen would like to be clear of it all. That he has no eagerness for war, no desire to take anything that belongs to anyone else. And yet that back of all this reluctance, there is a readiness to accept responsibility if, in the end, war cannot be averted. Mr. Chamberlain, up to the time while we were listening to him, was outlining what I think may go down in history as a timetable for this war. Item after item, he indicated the calm and then later the desperate measures which the British government had taken in order to prevent this impending catastrophe. He pointed out, as you observed in the beginning of his speech, that Great Britain in a crisis like this might have taken one of three courses. The British might have threatened war against Hitler. They might have stood aside and let Europe, as the saying goes, stew in its own juice. Or they might have attempted mediation. That, as we all know, was the choice of the British government, to attempt mediation. And following that policy, Lord Runciman, as Mr. Chamberlain pointed out, was sent to Prague. Mr. Chamberlain also indicated that the Runciman mission to Prague was an exceedingly hard mission. You remember that at the time he was sent, Lord Runciman is said to have declared to Neville Chamberlain, "It looks to me as though you're putting me out to sea in a boat without any oars." And Neville Chamberlain is said to have replied to Lord Runciman, "That's just about the case." And that certainly is the way it seems to have turned out. Then Mr. Chamberlain goes on in this calm and deliberate and unimpassioned manner to outline item by item the efforts of the British government to keep peace and the way in which on the other side the pressure for war has increased. He says that the Sudeten leaders, after Lord Runciman went to Prague, appeared to give consent to the Benish plan. The plan which was at that time under discussion was the fourth plan, a plan which would involve autonomy for the Sudeten Germans under a form of government somewhat similar to the cantonal system of Switzerland. That fourth plan, however, and the willingness of the Sudeten leaders to accept it, was evidently overruled by two things. In the first place, it was overruled by the development of incidents, border incidents, those sort of atrocity stories that have been coming out of the Sudeten area, which may be rumor, which may possibly be fact. That increased the irritation and increased the tension. And on the other hand, Herr Hitler himself intervened and made it plain that he would not accept the fourth plan which Lord Runciman developed at Prague. Then Mr. Chamberlain goes on to indicate that in July, as far back as the middle of July, Lord Halifax, the British foreign minister, who's been very close to Herr von Ribbentrop, he wrote a personal letter to Herr von Ribbentrop. Von Ribbentrop, as you may recall, was at one time British German ambassador to Great Britain. He was long time before that a wine salesman. He was picked out of obscurity by Herr Hitler. He is now the white-haired boy in the brain trust that surrounds Herr Hitler. And one of the individuals who prevents Herr Hitler, we're told, from discovering the actual truth of conditions as they prevail in other countries. And so Lord Halifax, who had entertained von Ribbentrop frequently when he was in London, addressed a personal appeal to him in the hope that he might carry that personal appeal to Hitler. But on the heels of this letter, the British government made the discovery that the Germans were increasing their mobilization. The scare maneuvers of last summer got underway. And as Chamberlain indicated, those scare maneuvers were not the ordinary maneuvers of an army in the field. They were the beginning of a universal mobilization of a nation which appeared to be bent on going to war. As a matter of fact, as we all now know, some 2 million Germans were either called actually to arms or were mobilized for war service. You remember also that at that time, every German male inside the country, up to 65 years of age, was refused permission to leave the country. All the ex-army officers up to 65 years of age were recalled to the colors. Men were taken from the stores and from the factories and from the fields. In the first week following this scare maneuver, the employment of women in the department stores in Berlin increased by more than 50%, which is just one small indication of this universal mobilization, this preliminary to war, which Mr. Chamberlain, stating his case, is building up. And that's an interesting sidelight also, that in these maneuvers, all the doctors and the nurses of Germany were conscripted for service, including all the Jewish doctors and the Jewish nurses. Well, that was the first in the specific stages through which Mr. Chamberlain is taking these developments. In the second place, Mr. Chamberlain suggested, these developments that Mr. Chamberlain suggested, that the German government appeared to be determined to settle this issue by force. And so the British Prime Minister instructed the British ambassador at Berlin, Sir Neville Henderson, the man on whose shoulders has fallen the burden of these diplomatic dealings with the German government, instructed Sir Neville Henderson to tell the British government to tell the German government that Great Britain could not look with unconcern upon the maneuvers of the German army on such a scale it seemed to threaten war. That's item number two. First, the Halifax letter to Ribbentrop. Second, the Henderson appeal to the British government. Likewise, Henderson, in the third step, appealed to von Ribbentrop himself. And von Ribbentrop, instead of taking in a good mood this effort of the British to preserve peace, is said to have replied to Sir Neville Henderson that the British mission to Prague, that is, the Runciman mission to Prague, was not making matters better, that on the contrary, the Runciman mission in Prague was making matters worse. That was step number three. Step number four took place on August 30th. On that day, Sir Neville Henderson, again in Berlin, went round the corner from the British Embassy there in Berlin to Wilhelmstrasse, where the German Foreign Ministry is, and there he made another strong statement on the British attitude, a statement which indicated that in the event that force is used, there would probably be no doubt of Britain's intervention. This, at the same time, was likewise repeated to Von Ribbentrop by Mr. Chamberlain himself. That's step number four. Step number five was on the eve of the Nuremberg Conference. At the time of the Nuremberg Conference, Britain, the British government, appears to have been on edge. Concessions, it seemed as though concessions were necessary in order to clear the atmosphere prior to that occasion. Consequently, Dr. Benisch was appealed to. Dr. Benisch consented to make concessions in order to calm the atmosphere prior to Hitler's speech at Nuremberg. Consequently, a new plan was proposed and offered to the German government in order that the atmosphere might somewhat be calmed prior to that frenzied occasion. Then, however, to make the situation worse prior to Nuremberg, these border incidents increased, and the situation became again more irritating. Before the Nuremberg conference, however, in step number six, the British government made further approaches to Henderson and to the Germans, and appealed specifically to the men closest to Adolf Hitler in the hope that they might somewhat tone down his Nuremberg speech. That was item number six. Item number seven. Number seven were on the 7th and 9th of September in this year when the first war preparations of the British were taken. When the British government, beginning against its will to see that peace perhaps could not be preserved, ordered the commission of mine layers and sweepers and made a general statement of loyalty to the French to indicate that in a time of crisis, the British would stand with the French. Then item number eight, Hitler in September 12th laid stress on Czech military preparations and for the first time in his Nuremberg speech said that Germany would go to the rescue of the Sudeten Germans.
You have just heard a commentary on the European crisis by Mr. Stanley High, noted journalist and commentator. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
But now the crowd are rushing across the road from the embankment side, and the crowd are cheering. They're running along the pavement with the three cars coming along, three of them. They're running along the pavement level with the third car. They're waving their banners, they're waving their hats, and people are rushing across the road. Right below me, one or two people who obviously were not really come to this, so they couldn't help it for a moment, and they've dashed right across the road and lined themselves up with the people. Car comes, and with it, a policeman running along beside it. It's going very slowly. Now they've gone right round the car. The police can't help to keep them back. They've stampeded round the car. People have mysteriously appeared from everywhere. They've crowded round it. They're cheering. They're waving. They're giving a terrific cheer to him.
I've never seen it. They're smiling down now from a window. Yelling for a speech from him, and as he looks down with a smile that is pleased, out he comes again, looking out of the window. Everybody's saying shush, trying to quieten the crowd so that Mr. Chamberlain can make a speech. And I'm afraid you won't be able to catch his speech very well, but if he does speak and I can catch what he says, I'll try to convey something to you of what he said. He's holding up his hand now for a crowd to quieten down. Everybody shouting for quiet. Quiet, everybody saying quiet. My good friends, this is the second time in my history that there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor. He's referring to Disraeli's great triumph from the Congress of Berlin in 1874, who also brought back peace with honor.
And here is Mr. Chamberlain.
There's only two things I want to say. First of all, I've received an immense number of letters during all these anxious times, and so has my wife. Letters of support and approval and gratitude. And I can't tell you what an encouragement that has been to me. I want to thank the British people for what they have done. Next, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
Now you can hear the cheers and the cries of well done, Mr. Chamberlain, and three cheers for Neville and various things like that. The police are having to fight away for Mr. Chamberlain. It's a real triumph, this arrival. How much more impressive it is than any other one that he's made in the last 2 weeks. Almost as soon as he'd finished. Oh, now listen. You know what, that's a very tuneless version of, for he's a jolly good fella. I see a big bunch of red and yellow flowers there which haven't succeeded in greeting him, although I know they were meant to. Now the crowd pushes round the car. Now, if you wanted to see a British crowd in real enthusiasm, you've heard that one. Mr. Chamberlain's car's driven away round the corner of the aerodrome control block here. The crowds are fighting their way behind it as he goes on his way towards Whitehall. Before we finish from here, may I say to viewers, will you please just stay where you are for the moment, because Freddie Griswold's coming back to you again in a moment. To sound listeners, to those in America who may have been listening, and to anybody else on the air, you may expect, I hope, to hear something of Mr. Chamberlain's triumphant arrival in the Whitehall area in something like 3/4 of an hour's time. For the moment, we say to you goodbye from Heston Airport.